Welcome to the MacGuffin Men. I'm Alex, and with me, as usual, is James. Hot start this time. No theme song. We're just getting right into it.
Whoa.
What are we talking about here today, James?
We are finally talking about Ad Astra.
Yeah. Brad Pitt is in a movie, so ipso facto, we have to talk about it on this podcast. It seems to be one of our rules at this point.
Yeah, and we're both on record of liking The Lost City of Zed.
Oh, yeah. I'm also on record as liking every single one of James Gray's movies. Yeah,
that's right.
And I'm also on record as saying you would like every single one of James Gray's movies, despite the fact that you haven't seen them all. Which is
It's been since 2016 that he said he was going to make the most realistic depiction of space, which was a rather bold claim.
Yeah. Yeah, I feel like they track temperatures in Celsius in space, number one, as opposed to Fahrenheit, as they do in a lot of this movie, but tomato.
Oh, that's true. Also, one more nitpicky thing in listening to the press tour for this from James Gray and listening to people review this movie, I've heard The Lost City of Z be said too many times.
For sure.
And I thought that went down in history as The Lost City of Zed. I thought that debate was closed. But
It definitely is The Lost City of Zed, but he's still an American, so he's still going to put a stamp on it, even though he knows it should be pronounced Zed. And it's pronounced Zed in the film. But we talked about that on that podcast. But how
I know. I thought it was settled. Anyway. Get back on the right side of history.
To get back to the nitpicky thing, that's the Fahrenheit Celsius thing is something my friend Angela pointed out to me, and I think my immediate response was like, "Yeah, well, I don't care." And that's kind of where I sit on a lot of sci-fi stuff. Like, I saw this movie again yesterday and was surrounded by people who were obsessed with space accuracy. And listening to their conversations at the end of the movie, I was just like, why are you even here? If you like, read the textbook. And James Gray, like, I know that's the most prominent quote we've seen, or I've seen in reading about this movie, him talking about the realism, or making the most realistic space movie ever. He has 100% walked that back since making these bold claims. And he says, he's like, yeah, I tried that. And then you get to a point where narrative context means more than realism. And you just sort of have to get around the fact that, like, you can't make something that's super real, 100% realistic. You have to start from a place of wanting to do that so that you can, the times when something happens where there's a moment in this movie where Brad Pitt asked for a tear on his face to be like, to float away from his eye as opposed to actually drip down his face, because that's how it would have been in the scene. And James Gray said, no, the acting's too good. And that's kind of where he's coming from, where it's just like, we're using realism until realism gets in the way of the story, or the trek this character is on, you know, emotionally and physically.
Yeah, I think that's definitely true. And you can hear him kind of say that in interviews where he really kind of says that, you know, kind of what you've just said there, that just emotionally sometimes it doesn't make sense to be completely accurate. And
yeah,
this isn't a science textbook. And you know, he did put a lot of work into making things look good and look accurate, but there is a point where that the trade-off just isn't worth it for the sake of art at a certain point. And I do also feel, however, that it's just really hard sometimes. I think he kind of, there's all these space movies, you know, Gravity and 2001, you know, there's all these movies set in space that are just famously really hard to shoot and really hard to find ways to accurately depict. And I think,
Kubrick worked 4 years on 2001, I believe, and Cuarón, I think it was 3 or 4 on Gravity as well. You know?
Yeah, and so I heard an interview with him recently where he says, you think that because technology has come so far, it's just going to make this so much easier, that with all these advances in technology, making, you know, depicting something that's an artificial representation of something else that isn't accessible to us all the time only becomes easier and easier. But then he points out that in movies being made in the, I don't know, 30s, if you had to depict space, you know, you had basically a dialogue track and a score track for sound, and that's it. And now, because we've come so far that we can do all these interesting things with sound design, and that's the example he used, there is also just a ton more things to worry about and a bunch of different layers of sound to get absolutely right. So as our technology develops that we can make more accurate representations of things, we also have to fill in all those different tracks and do all these things that people didn't have to care about before. So it's harder and easier at the same time. And I think that that's one of those things that you bump into when you're trying to do something accurately is, yeah, we do kind of now have the technology to make a tear turn into a little ball of water and just float away. But how is that going to look and how well can we depict that when that's something that's not really, you know, something accessible to us?
Yeah, exactly. And adding to the whole degree of difficulty thing, increasing with time. So to go back to 2001, like 2001 was a huge popular, was a big hit, I believe. And the reason it was just because they had shots of space. Like they figured out how to get a shot of a spacecraft like floating. And that was the big effect. You know, you didn't have to also have an action sequence on top of that. You know, you didn't have to do like Mad Moon Fury Road or whatever, like what happens in this movie. And so that adds another layer of challenges. And like you said, these things exist all throughout the movie, and increasing technology also brings new difficulties. Like you have to come up with a new creative action sequence in one of these movies because that's what people expect, but you also need it to be something new, so it's something memorable to them. And you know, like any art form as it ages, like the you have to be more creative to come up with something that's new and interesting. And I don't know, by having more technological advances, as you said, it almost like limits you to an extent. Like you have to do these certain things just to feed into what the audience expects from filmmaking, like technically and also storytelling.
Yeah, no doubt. Mm-hmm. I'll say that I thought this movie did a good job of pulling in pretty much everybody right away. That opening antenna scene, I think that's the very first thing, right?
Yeah, there's like the very short intro of Brad Pitt doing his or Roy doing his whatever we're calling that testing, psychological testing, and then, you know, some cutaways, but it's like a minute and then we've got Brad Pitt walking to the space antenna.
Yeah, and I just think that it hooked everybody in. I mean, it got me, I think, just listening to anybody else talk about it or write about it too. No matter kind of their feelings on this movie, that I think was just a great hook, and I think it looked very cool, and it you know, so many literal POV shots. It really just kind of puts you in to that position. And I've heard a lot of things that people don't like about this movie, and people have some things to say about that, but the quality of the action scenes, and I'll call that an action scene, that kind of seems to be beyond reproach. And some people will argue whether those are necessary or those are a bit of studio intervention to make this a bit more pulse pounding to try to get people in the seats. But I just thought that initial scene was such an incredible hook and worked out so well.
Yeah, for sure. And it's not like it's this totally removed. Like, I agree with you. I think it's the best action sequence in the movie if we're talking about those. But it also sort of sets up the idea of the search. Like, what is this that caused this? And it just sort of propels Roy into the meetings that he has that end up set him on his journey. It's not like it's like this is his life, and then he goes to this unconnected meeting afterwards. You know?
Yeah, no, that's true. And we get to see what Roy looks like under pressure, which is remarkably similar to what people look like not under pressure, which is very, very calm and relaxed.
Yeah, so it establishes a lot of what we need to know about Roy through an action sequence. Just like I think the lunar car chase drives home a lot of the things that James Gray and company seem to be trying to say about about space travel in general and humanity in general. And I think all of these action sequences the bigger the action sequence, I think the more they tried to fit something into it that ties in thematically to the rest of the movie. Yeah.
Okay. And yeah. You think, and they did it well.
Oh, for sure.
Okay.
Yeah. And James Gray has been like, James Gray has been forthcoming on blank is something that we're going to be saying a lot throughout this podcast, because he's forthcoming on everything. But he's just sort of been pretty upfront about how those aren't his favorite sequences to direct. But he also realizes, like, if you're making a movie like this, you kind of need them. And he doesn't necessarily want to make them, but he likes watching them, you know. And he sort of views it as a necessary evil that I feel like was a necessary evil at the script stage. It's not like they were selling this movie and then somebody said, you need more action sequences. Like, We on the Night is a movie that is very good and very genre, like very cop genre. And it felt like there's a car chase sequence in that movie that it felt like was there in the original script. And it's just sort of, James Gray feels like these movies need something to sort of propel the audience or keep the audience excited, I guess. Yeah.
And well, we'll just zoom out a little bit before I get a bit more micro. How did you feel about this movie overall?
I like it a lot. I have some concerns that I have since done some or some things I don't love about it that I've since done some research on, and we can talk about those, but pretty small. I mean, it's a James Gray movie. I'm in every time.
I know you're intrigued. It doesn't mean you have to like the end result.
No, it's fantastic. He's so talented. Brad Pitt's amazing. I don't have anything new to offer as far as like a star rating on this movie. I kind of align myself with the critics on it. I think it's a fantastic movie, and I feel like I'm one viewing away from really, really loving it, but I'm certain the next viewing I'm going to be like, oh, this movie's amazing. You know, this feels like a movie where after we do this podcast, I see it again and I'm just like, shit, I wish we did the podcast a week later. And then I end up writing something about a movie that we've already podcasted about. It's the Blade Runner 2049 conundrum.
Well, you want to just turn this into Ad Podcastro, where we just review Ad Astro every time you watch it?
Yeah, let's just do that.
Give the people what they want.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. So yeah, that's, I say yes, and I feel like I will one day love this movie, but I'm not quite there yet. What about yourself?
I think I'm in a similar spot. I'm not as confident that my feelings about it are only going to trend upwards. Mm-hmm. I think that, yeah, Brad's great. It seems to go without saying. That seems to be kind of just the universal response to this. So I got no hot take for you there.
Yeah.
I think it, yeah, I just, I don't know that it'll age well, even just for me. Mm-hmm. I think that, I don't know, I came across the word nuance in a review, and I think this movie really is largely without nuance. Mm-hmm. I think that it's really spelled out for you, and I think that sometimes that upon, you know, anything that seems heavy-handed usually doesn't seem less heavy-handed after repeat viewings, and you know, unless there's something that I missed about it. It does feel that there's, I mean, maybe saying that there's no nuance to it is unfair, but some of the dialogue, some of the voiceover stuff, I was kind of surprised that it was so on the nose. It is kind of incredible how blatantly emotional this movie is. And I think that the worst thing I can say about this movie, I think, is that it tries to have it both ways. It tries to have this very calm, laconic character that is very interior about his feelings, and then the way that they tell his story is so open. You know, we have a voiceover narration plus constant psych evaluations that he says out loud. And I think that psych evaluation things make a ton of sense. I think that is, there would be some kind of artificial intelligence that is constantly evaluating the psychological profile of these people during a mission like this. It would make no sense for there not to be. Mm-hmm. So I'm not saying that was a crutch that they had him state his mental state that frequently, because that makes a ton of sense. But as I said, I just think it tries to have it both ways by having this character, but inside this form, it seems a little too much to me. You know, when for example, him saying when we finally got to Neptune and he's met up with his father, Roy. Cliff. Cliff. And you know, he's pushing Roy away and say, "You got to let me go, son. You got to let me go." That's just too much spoon feeding for me. And again, maybe my repeat viewings will kind of level these opinions out, but that seems like something, the more I get exposed to it, the clunkier it's going to seem.
Okay. Yeah. I mean, that's certainly not my favorite line of the movie by any means, but I will offer two counterpoints.
Sure.
As somebody who has a lot of experience watching James Gray movies and then watching the James Gray movie a few years down the line again, his movies tend to age well, despite the fact that they're very... he does kind of paint in broad emotional strokes in pretty much all of his movies. And I just sort of think that for whatever reason, it ages well. And I think it's because he's such a classical stylist. Like, there's just something that, like, when he puts out a movie, it already feels old-fashioned, even when it's currently playing in theaters, you know? And and I think that just sort of lends to his ability to make a movie that still feels like out of time, I guess, down the line. And the other thing is, I think this is just, as somebody who kind of knows you, it's the Dark Knight boat scene conundrum to shoehorn Nolan into this conversation.
I bet he would have come up anyway.
He might have. He probably would have. But I bet people weren't betting on this, on The Dark Knight as being the movie we brought up first. But
that's true.
The Dark Knight boat sequence, talking to you after we first saw the movie, you were just like, it's like this 20-minute thing. It's like, it's 2 minutes. And then you watch it again, and you just sort of, you're more prepared for the thing that annoys you, so it's easier to ignore, and you start looking for the new things that I think will start to reveal themselves, or that I think were there obviously, but are just, on a first viewing, they were there to be noticed. But on a second viewing or third viewing, you start to sort of see the other little things that surround them that drive the good things about this movie home. So,
yeah, kind of where I am with this. I can see that.
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, the sons suffer the sins of the father.
Yeah.
That just, I don't know. It seems like there is a long list of things that if I was taking notes on, they'd pile up. And yeah, you could absolutely be right that those things would fall away as, you know, with repeat viewings and growing appreciation of everything else and making it look and feel more like a whole. Mm-hmm. But yeah, I think that's kind of symptomatic of something else where it does, I don't know, you can, to borrow a phrase that I heard recently that I like, is you can feel the razor blades cutting the film at times. Mm-hmm. You know what I mean? Like the jumps from scene to scene, they don't always feel seamless, and that this movie is so much about Roy, obviously, you know, no news there, but I don't know, just the way that sometimes it does follow his story in a manner that jumps a lot, I feel seems clunky as well sometimes.
I like that about it. I think it's sort of like this movie a lot of times feels like the joints in your body exist, but all the cartilage has been worn away, you know, like it's just sort of this you don't have any sort of like shock resistance. So it sort of is jarring, those jumps from a lot of the scenes, especially as we get further into the movie. And I really like that about the movie. I think that sort of shows us a continued disjointedness that Roy is feeling in his own head. And I think that's I think that's one of the coolest things about the movie, is that it's so tempting when you're making this big operatic space movie to just make it big and long and everything. And by the time the credits roll, we're at like what, an hour 50 in this movie. And I think the desire to push back against the idea that we're making a space movie, it should be 2.5 hours, you know, there's so much precedent for it. you know, going back 2001, Solaris, well, not the Soderbergh version, which is a tight 98, but Interstellar, just, you know, big. I mean, even First Man is 2 hours, 15 minutes, you know, and that's our most recent wide release space movie. And there's so much temptation to be able to justify, let's go big and long and just sort of really take our time with it. And maybe that's what Gray was doing initially and found it worked better faster in editing. And they just sort of cut away the things that were like, okay, I'm going to go to Mars now. You know, those things that I don't think matter and I think actually make Roy's character more interesting in that we see this sort of very disjointed story happening. Like, we know the point A to point B, and then there's just a lot of jaggedness on the line that's getting us there. I like that a lot, and I think it really speaks to Roy's inner, like, where he's coming from mentally inside. And I think just right off the bat, the first shot of this movie is that shot of, like, lens flares from the I don't remember what you're looking at, but it's some sort of planet or the sun or something. And the camera's panning across and we get all these little lens flares and you get this quick shot of Roy's head in one of them in his space helmet. It's sort of like almost like a reverse 2001, but with Brad Pitt instead of a baby. And I think that sort of also sets up that sort of fractured mindset. It's like there's all these very similar things following one after the other that Roy is in the middle of or like just barely a part of, but they're not connected. They're just kind of like, I don't know, they're just going, progressing through space. You know, that's all you really need to know. And the, I don't know, a clean line between the two doesn't really matter.
Yeah, I see that. And I really like that intro a lot, of just dwelling on these lens flares for a long time, mm-hmm. and then a bit of humanity and then back to this vastness, and just watching, I might have the wrong space and cinema words here, so your forgiveness would be appreciated. But just watching these hexagons line up in the lens flare, and then pass over each other, and then continue the other way. Just watching these light refraction, and just there's just something that's so scientific about it. You know, you're just really kind of living in this world of things that we're not used to dwelling on in our everyday life. But then when you have the amount of space and just the importance of time and distance and light, the way that it would matter so much more to someone in Roy's space than it does for us just walking around Earth all the time doing whatever it is we do, I thought that was, without saying anything, a nice way to just bring us into that kind of headspace before anything had happened. I really like that intro, considering there's not much to it.
Yeah, for sure. I agree.
And one thing, so I never saw First Man, but I kind of don't put it in that category. And again, since having not seen it, I shouldn't really be able to talk about it at all. But it does kind of seem like it came and went in a way that I was just thinking of this sort of mini genre lately, but Arrival, Interstellar, Blade Runner 2049, and Gravity kind of just seem like this little modernist space movies that take themselves seriously but deserve it. A lot of stuff about parenting and children and among those, yeah. This included. And it just didn't seem like First Man fit into that as much.
There's a lot about parenting and a lot about sadness in First Man. I will say, I love First Man so much. That movie's incredible, and the big swings they take in that movie. Oh my god, with like an iconic American human being to make the movie that they made and to have it build to what it's building to is just so. I can't say enough about how good First Man is. It's amazing.
Okay, well, maybe we'll talk about First Man on a separate First Man podcast. Yeah. But to get back to some of that disjointedness, I felt, and I've been looking for a different way to phrase this since I saw this movie, but things seem simultaneously so easy and so hard throughout this movie. Like, everything that happens, like, everything goes wrong, but then it gets kind of solved with a lot of ease at the same time. Mm-hmm. And I think that was something else that brought me to that kind of uneasy juxtaposition of the different feelings in this movie. And I think you've stated that you kind of like that, and that it does it plays more to a life experience, that there aren't these clean lines and there's not, you know, not everything's just this smooth arc. But I think sometimes things felt a little too smooth. I mean, a small example, and I don't want to just harp on this as like a plot hole kind of problem that I have in this movie, but the moon pirate scene, which I think is so great in so many ways, it looks fantastic, and I'm glad it wasn't the whole movie, but I kind of feel like I could watch 2 hours of of that kind of stuff. I thought it was just so engaging and looked so good. You know, his lunar rover goes over the side of a cliff and it's spinning out, and then he takes the wheel and it just lands so perfectly. And there's just something about, I get that Roy is calm and cool and awesome what he does, and to borrow a quote from another Brad Pitt movie, he walks into his room and his dick's already been there for 5 minutes. And I understand that we're supposed to see him as a great astronaut and a great leader and a great team member, like his father was, maybe not a great team member. Just things like that, of just these massive difficulties that it just, we seem to come up against, and we wonder how he's going to overcome them. And it's, the solution seems to be for just him to be him. And I think sometimes that falls a bit short for me. And that, I think, is the best example of it.
Okay. I see what you're saying, and I just don't care. You know, like, that's just not something that I care about. And I do recall, like, at one point during this movie, reminding myself, like, pretty late in the movie as he's getting to his father, and just being like, oh yeah, the whole world's at danger. I just didn't care. You know, I was purely following, like, Roy's story. You know, I didn't really care about the what was happening on Earth. I was there with Brad. You know, that's kind of where I was at. And I don't need to watch him struggle in the action sequences, because I'm watching him struggle plenty in the non-action sequences. So I don't share that issue with the film.
Okay. Yeah, yeah. I did like that the surges were causing these sort of, you know, obviously the space antenna scene that we talked about is visually intriguing, and you know, things explode, and we see things that are kind of more classic action set piece things, and, you know, him do dangerous things. But I liked that it was that 43,000 people were killed, or 40 something thousand people were killed in kind of just these isolated small accidents. And it wasn't as though, you know, Asia was destroyed or something. You know what I mean? I like that 43,000 people is a lot of people, but it's not a crazy amount of people. Hmm. And I really like that. You know, we talk a lot about the stakes of these things, and maybe some action movies that we care about less involve a country being decimated, and that's kind of what spurns us into the action. Mm-hmm. And I did enjoy that. Again, I know 43,000 people, if 43,000 people died in one day, or, you know, a few weeks or whatever this is, it would be a huge deal, and rightly so. But I did enjoy that they kind of played it smaller, when especially anything that we have the scope, you know, where our story takes us from Earth to Neptune, and there's, you know, all these, this big technology in play, that it wasn't, they didn't need a huge gory action-packed scene to, as our inciting incident. You know, we have this scene where, again, we have that antenna, we know people have died, we hear some people screaming, but they trust that that's enough to drive it home as an inciting incident, and I enjoyed that.
Yeah, you don't need the White House being blown up by an alien ship, you know?
Yeah, no, exactly. Yeah, for sure.
Okay. Where to now? I guess.
Oh, I don't know. I have. Jeez, I mean, we the only action scene I guess we haven't talked about is the baboon attack.
Yeah, great. Good times. Well, okay. So here's one thing I really enjoyed about this movie. First time I watched it, especially for the first hour, things kept happening where I was just like, oh, what is this movie? You know, like the antenna scene right off the top. I was like, oh, this is cool and new. Everything that happens on the moon, I was like, what is happening in this movie? The travel to the moon was really cool.
Just the commercial space flight, or how it was shot, or
that they're flying commercial, just the way that the humans who are living on the moon are set up, and it's just kind of like Earth, but now on the moon. I thought was great.
And I like the choice of Subway, but the choice of Hudson News, I think, is that's really great.
So fantastic. And the baboon attack and Mars. Basically, once he leaves Mars, it just sort of, that's when it sort of settles into the movie that I kind of would have expected. But all of these things happening and all these things looking so different from each other, I just thought that was really cool and adventurous. And I couldn't really get a hold of what this movie was being, or like a comparison point for this movie as it was happening. I mean, there's obvious ones. Apocalypse Now and Solaris are very obvious, but I mean, I spent a lot of time thinking about this movie and The Verdict, the Paul Newman, Sidney Lumet movie from the early 80s. And I just thought...
Why The Verdict?
Paul Newman's journey and Roy's journey are not super dissimilar. It's not a father-son thing in The Verdict, but it's somebody... The Verdict is all about somebody looking around the world that he is inhabiting and looking for something else within it and trying to convince himself that something else is what he wants. And it's also a very quiet, understated performance by a legacy Hollywood star. I think that's a very good double bill if you want to have a fun evening. The Verdict and Ad Astra back to back. It's great.
Are fun the words?
To me they are. But yeah, and I just sort of, I felt like the movie was hard to grasp, and then once you get to basically right before Tommy Lee Jones shows up, it sort of becomes the movie I anticipated. And I just thought that was really cool. Like the number of times in the first half of this movie, I thought to myself, what is this movie? Was way higher than I would have anticipated. And that's always a positive as far as I'm concerned. I always want like something that catches me off guard. Yeah.
And yeah, I get that.
Yeah.
And so you mentioned Paul Newman, you mentioned that this is sort of a iconic star. We've kind of been talking about Roy, and we haven't talked about Brad Pitt that much. Mm-hmm. And that seems to be sort of a focal point. I think that there's the meta-text to this movie that I think a lot of people are finding a lot of value in. And just listening to James Gray talk about this, you know, Brad Pitt and Plan B produced Lost City of Zed.
Mm-hmm.
And he was going to be in that and then was unable to and was happy to be involved in this. And
could you imagine Brad Pitt being the lead of Lost City of Zed? I don't think we actually talked about this on the podcast. Like,
I think we must have.
I don't know. I just don't think it would have worked.
Like, no?
Name a movie where he has done an accent in a serious movie that has worked. Yeah.
Yeah. You're just such a Charlie Hunnam head.
Exactly.
You can't see past it. That's something else. But anyway, I just hearing James Gray speak about him knowing that it would be Brad Pitt to star in this one, and that not only do you get him as a performer in this that he was excited about, but you get, you know, he said something, I'm paraphrasing, but something like you get the chance to play with his legacy. And so it's not just what he's going to do on screen, but everything he's done in the past on and off screen that allows you to have sort of a metatextual interaction with this film and this character. What do you get from that, like, you personally?
So I think the thing that I see a lot is loneliness, just in general, about how lonely it must be to be somebody that famous. And I think the way that they set it up is at the very beginning of the movie, as he's walking out to the antenna, and he's just walking through this crowd of people who are never really introduced to us and we'll never see again. One guy's giving him Roy's wearing his helmet, he's ready to go out. One guy's giving him the middle finger. As he's going out the door, the guy says, be safe out there or whatever, and Roy's response is, thanks for that. And it's just like the most the most nothing interaction, and it just feels like something that must happen to Brad Pitt all the time. Somebody just noticing him on the street and saying something that he has to respond to, and it's just totally meaningless. And that he does all of this with this sort of protective shell around him, I think, is really notable. And they set it up there so that they never really have to directly address it again. And throughout the movie, we get a few instances of people, most notably when he's traveling from the moon to Mars, everybody on the ship with him, the four other crew members, already know who he is. You know, he's famous in some capacity, if only famous as Clifford's son. And that, as well as the meeting where he finds out about the mission, about Lima and all, and his dad maybe still being alive, NASA mission, that's sort of like everybody is, the way everybody talks to him is the way that you talk to somebody who you're unsure how to interact around, because you have a personal experience with them that they did not share, because it's just sort of this famousness thing. Like, we have personal experiences with Brad Pitt that he 100% does not share, because unless something has happened in your life, then you've met Brad Pitt in the last couple of weeks and didn't tell me about it. Like, we have no personal interactions with Brad Pitt, you know? And it's just sort of like,
think of how mad you'd be if that happened.
It would depend on the interaction. If you're just like, hey, Brad, and he says, thanks for that, I guess I'd be pretty like, wow, that's cool. But if you're just like, I don't know, I'm playing Frolf with him and he didn't call me, I'd be like, this is the one time I'm in the Frolf.
I meant that I didn't tell you more than, I know you're not like a celebrity driven person. That would be a sense that if I got to stand next to him and not talk to him. But
I mean, how would you even word that text message though? It's just, anyway, it doesn't matter. This
this really doesn't matter.
No, but just the way that sort of is a part of the movie, you just, it just adds to a further feeling of loneliness and isolation and just this existence by himself that I can only imagine Brad Pitt sort of identified with when reading the screenplay, and that James Gray was more than happy to sort of put in there initially, and then also double down on it once he realized just how famous his lead was going to, or just how famous the person playing his lead is going to be.
Yeah.
So.
Yeah. And one thing I did like about this is that it is so much about Roy, obviously. And I mean, some people say that that's to the detriment of this movie, that they have all these good actors in this movie that just don't get to do anything and don't really register. But it's quite clear that this is a story about him, but I really did like how much of how we see sort of the team dynamics. I think that's something that comes across as people traveling these great distances in, you know, these little metal boxes. It is so important. And I think Tanner, I think, is the captain for a while. And you just get the sense that there are so few people capable of doing jobs like this for so many reasons. You have to be very intelligent, but you have to have a certain level of interpersonal skills, and you have to do things that you don't want to do and not let it look like you don't want to do them. And I just think they did a good job. And yeah, that the moon to Mars thing, especially when they're all together, and the constant psychological evaluations, as we talked about earlier, the notion of the personality of somebody is so important in these instances. And I do like how, you know, when they're deciding who's going to do the spacewalk, it's the captain who just has to do it and has to never pretend that they never even didn't want to go do this incredibly dangerous thing. Mm-hmm. And yeah, just for a movie that's about insularity and one person, I did think that there is more about interaction than a lot of people seem to be giving it credit for.
Yeah, that's true. And it's just sort of this short-term interaction that's everybody understands as a part of the game, and you just sort of have to be professional with these people at all times, and just because if you slip for a minute, then maybe the whole mission slips for a minute, you know.
So. Yeah, and there's just such a you know, we think of these feelings that we have about other people as so much of our own and so important to us, and they are, but to do something at this scale, you're just not you're not allowed to have that sort of selfishness. And I think that that's, again, something about Roy and Cliff and Brad Pitt. There's just this part that you kind of have to give over to everybody else that that just comes with the job. And I think I think a really great part of this movie is when he's in his the coolest recording booth in, I guess, the universe, not even on Earth. But and he goes off script and he speaks to his father very frankly. And I think that it's very emotionally effective, obviously. I think that it gets to you just because what's being said and how it's being said is very powerful, I think. But the notion that he gets taken off the mission, you know, that it's the one thing he had to do was be emotionally effective enough for his father to respond, and you know he's responding very reluctantly, but the very nature of him being that connected to it is what makes the message successful, but what makes him an unsuitable candidate. And I think that sort of catch 22, I think, is really central to this, that it's his role in, you know, it's that it is his father is why he gets his chance to be on this mission, but it's exactly why he's not allowed to proceed any further. And I think that's really rough.
Yeah, for sure. I agree. And I mean, I think that's the center point, or the easiest part of this movie to point to and say Brad Pitt is very good, obviously, because of this. It's his scene that a lesser actor would have gone full Mark Ruffalo in Spotlight, maybe. And and I think it's worth pointing out that that's as big as Brad Pitt goes in this movie. And I don't know, I think it just works so perfectly. And I think it really speaks a lot to what I enjoy about him as an actor, especially as he ages, because, you know, when he was younger, he was so notable for his energy. Like, you watch the guy playing Mills, I think it's Mills in, Mills in Somerset and Seven. And the guy playing Roy and Ad Astra, and it's just like Mills is all energy all the time and Roy is the exact opposite. And I think even in this decade we've seen Brad Pitt really just slow down everything, and when he say something like War Machine, where he goes full bore, like weirdo character actor sort of thing, and then doing something like this where he's just static all the time, and there are a few moments of him just looking off in the distance at something that are just heartbreaking, even when there's like no real clear emotional attachment to what he's looking at. Like when he lets go of when he's trying to dock with the ship that his father's on, and his craft just won't dock, and he lets it go, and it's like he's looking at like his last remaining connection to Earth, like sort of just going away, and just the way he looks at this thing that, like, I don't know, it doesn't seem like it would be something that that person in that moment would be like pausing to say goodbye to, you know? But then he's just sort of, it drives home how afraid he is of seeing his father, which he thinks might happen. And I don't know, I think that just that moment where none of these things are explained to you and they're just explained through Brad Pitt's face, and I just think he's looking at something that's not alive and never has been, I think is that's a really great moment, and I think really drives home how compelling he can be without doing anything, you know?
Yeah, and I don't want to circle back to this for too long, because I do want to talk about his meeting with his father, obviously, because that's very central to this. But that's, I feel like there's just those moments are few and far between, not of him reacting well, because I think he does a lot of, you know, the acting reacting thing in this film. The ratio, I think, is pretty good for a performance that you'd like. But that is a moment where something kind of goes unsaid. He doesn't, you know, say, oh, you know, there goes my last chance home or whatever, or now I got to really see my father. That, you know, that goes unstated, and I think that's for the benefit. But I feel like that's rare. I think there's so many other times in this movie that value would be increased by what's not being said. I think that, you know, I just think about the Blade Runner edit with the voiceover and without the voiceover, and how it's just universally accepted that that was a bad idea, and that the voiceover, the narration, says too much, and that there's space to breathe in this movie where you kind of get to do some thinking and the movie doesn't do the thinking for you. I think that, and not that this can't have narration, but it just seems like especially your opinion of things, it does feel like it usually, the movie is better off for not spoon feeding you, and that there could be space for you to come to your own conclusions. And I've been thinking about this movie a lot since I saw it, but I don't know how much I don't have figured out about it. And that usually seems to be something that you like walking away from a movie, is not knowing everything and still being able to make up your minds about things, or come to some realization on a reviewing that, oh, that's what he might be considering, or this thing is in play in a way that I hadn't considered on the first viewing. And I just really think they put it all out there and don't leave a lot of space.
Well, the one thing I will say, the difference between Blade Runner voiceover and Ad Astra voiceover, is it's a difference between explaining the plot and actually what's happening, and the voiceover in Ad Astra is purely emotional from Roy's perspective. You know, it's giving us his inner thoughts about his own life, as opposed to his inner thoughts about where he's going. You know, he's like, well, now I'm going to the moon, you know, like, yeah. And then that guy from Miami Vice made me a unicorn out of origami, you know, like, that's the Blade Runner thing. You know, this is more the Terrence Malick voiceover, which I am a noted super fan. So yeah, it doesn't bother me. And I think the reason it doesn't bother me is because the face journey that Brad Pitt is taking on this whole film, it's just compelling enough. I just care about him because he's Brad Pitt, and because I've decided over time that I care about Brad Pitt and want him to succeed. And that's another thing that he brings to the role, is that, like, from the first second of this movie, I'm just like, I'm on Roy's side. You know, you never have to worry about it. And I think the journey he's on can be read in a variety of different ways. Like, I think the way that I've seen it described a lot, and this is a theme in a lot of James Gray movies, is the idea of taking down the great man, you know, the great American male, and this sort of toxic masculinity that comes with somebody like the character that Clifford is. And that's pretty self-explanatory, you know, like, one thing I have not mentioned about this movie that I love, and you will laugh at this because, of course, I love this, but, like, Roy
takes his shirt off.
No, Roy travels all the way to Neptune and to see his father, and then his father almost immediately tells him to go fuck himself, and they never cared about him. I loved that. That was so surprising to me, and that's so, like, spitting in the face of what you expect a father-son movie to be. And yeah, I think that is something that can't be understated as being so, so cool in this movie, is that it's a quest to see a father played by an actor who other people like. I know he plays plenty of difficult characters, but most people like Tommy Lee Jones as an actor. You know, it's not like,
yeah,
we're putting,
yeah,
somebody in there who's just sort of a dummy character actor who nobody has any real attachment to. But, you know, it's Oscar winner, famous, has a long, long career. And then he's just immediately, like, does something that just feels so villainous, like just telling a son who has traveled so far and who he has already abandoned and who has, ruined his Roy's mother's life, all these things, and just, he's immediately like, I never thought about you. That's that's beyond cold as ice. That's cold as, like, space, you know, like, it's incredible. And oh god, I love it. I love everything about Clifford, and how the whole movie ends up being about, like, what the fuck is he accomplishing? He's accomplishing nothing, because he finds no evidence of human life. All he does is leave this horror in his wake, and or this broken family, and he doesn't even care about what he's left in his wake. And I love it. I love it so much.
No, I know. When we say, you know, he traveled so far to see his father,
yeah,
I still think we put it in our terms. It's like driving 2 hours to another town to go see your dad. It's, yeah, like, no, this is so, like, orders of magnitude crazier and more difficult than that. It's interplanetary and the chance of death constantly. And I love the conversation, because even Roy is still so reticent when he sees him. You know, you can tell he's, I guess, has a positive feeling about seeing him in general, or at least some kind of relief that he's made it that far. Mm-hmm. And yeah, Cliff just has nothing even close to that. And I enjoyed just from a filmmaking standpoint where so many of the shots of Cliff in that scene, we see him through a grate or through a window. You know, there's still not that many perfectly clear shots of him. There is still, after all this insane journey, there's still something in the way. There's still this separation between the two of them. And, you know, that's quite clear by the way that he talks to him as though, you know, you shouldn't have come here, basically. You should just go home now. But I like that that is told, you know, through mise-en-scène as well.
Yeah, absolutely. And just to go back to another Brad Pitt performance thing is when he's being told that his dad never thought about him, the shot of him looking at him as he's hearing these things, he somehow conveys that like he's really sad to hear that, but that he knew it all along. And I think that's so that's another moment of Brad Pitt where, I mean, if you put all of the moments I love of Brad Pitt in this movie like back to back, you know, or my highlight moments, they probably all look exactly the same, but are somehow conveying different emotions just through his face. And I think that's so cool. And it's so I don't want to say risky to play something like this so small. But it is. It's something that like nobody's first thought when reading a script, no actor's first thought when reading a script of that scene would be to not move at all and just explain it all through their face. But that's what Brad Pitt does throughout this movie, and I just think that's so. It's such an interesting performance that way. You know, I said on the Once Upon a Time in Hollywood podcast, he can simultaneously do so big and so small simultaneously, and that's this whole fucking movie. Like it's incredible.
Yeah, no, I know. And just even before reading the script, even just knowing the log line of this movie and having some indication that he is going to be his father after, you know, what you can assume is a pretty harrowing adventure, to have it be so nothing, I think, yeah, is pretty wonderful.
Yeah, and I think to go back to the stuff with Cliff, and I think that ties into the whole movie in that it sort of becomes, especially with the stuff on the moon that I loved so much, which Roy points out in the voiceover.
His father would hate and would tear it all down if he could see it.
Well, his father would hate and would tear it all down if he could see it, but also, like, why are we just repeating the same mistakes that we've made on Earth in the moon? Why bother leaving the planet if you can't fix the planet you're already on? And that's exactly what Cliff does as well. You know, he would tear it down if he could see it. His thing seems to be to not look back at what he's left in his wake, you know? And maybe he would hate the man he became if he could see 30 years into the future when before he left Earth or whatever, but he just sort of keeps trucking forward, and I think that's it's just like, oh, we got to try this new thing, we got to try this new thing, just see what we can do, and continually that adds another level to the wake that you're leaving behind. And just to see all the branding on the moon, the escalator that looks exactly like an escalator that I took on the subway yesterday or whatever.
Yeah.
All of that stuff is just so interesting because you're making a movie about going deeper into space than any human has ever gone. And the question is, why are we doing this at all? You know, like what is this accomplishing? And again, I think that's really cool.
Yeah, and the notion that this gets talked about near the end as well, that I think it's Roy communicating it to Cliff would make the most sense, that he did find nothing, but that's finding something, you know, that it's he did all this, he came out this far, came all the way to Neptune to find extraterrestrial life, and he sees it as a failure that he couldn't find anything.
Yeah.
And Roy
Cliff
frames
does,
his, yeah, Cliff, yeah. And then Roy frames it as that is an accomplishment to know, you know, you're kind of proving the negative. You know, that is something that I don't mean qualitatively negative, but just this notion that we are alone. You know, you say Roy just keeps moving forward without looking back. And then I think that if there's nothing else out there, if we've reached the edge of the solar system, of the universe, and found that there's nothing else to look for, that you have to turn around and you have to, you know, and when you turn around, you see home and you have to go home and you have to look at those things. And the distant relationship that Roy has with, I'm going to call her Liv Tyler because I didn't really have enough time to grip onto what her name was in this
I think it's
movie.
Eve.
Yeah, I think that's right too, actually. But I think I'm forgiven for not quite remembering that for
We'll get into that.
whatever role she was given. That forces you to turn around, and maybe this is a clunky visual metaphor as well, but it's the very destruction of his father's little moon base, or is not his Neptune base, that forces him back home. You know, he has no fuel to keep going, and it's only by letting go of that idea of his father, which embodies his quest to just keep going outward at the expense of anybody in his life, that's what propels him back home, and that's what forces him to kind of reckon with who he is and what he's done, and the choices he's made in his personal life, you know, the things that aren't how good he is at handling space operations, but how good he is at dealing with the interpersonal things of the people closest to him.
Yeah, for sure. And just to add to the point, I think you're making, like, you've talked about Roy, but Clifford not being willing to turn around. His whole thing is that he just keeps to I believe quote the voiceover, like, he could only see what wasn't there. You know, he just continually is like, no, I've got to keep looking, I've got to keep looking. And
I just haven't found the aliens yet. I have to keep looking.
exactly exactly and the point of the movie is that, like, at some point you just have to be satisfied with the limits of your own of human existence and of your own life, and that's what Roy realizes at the movie, and he does the thing his father never would do, and he turns back and goes back to Earth to see what was already in front of him the whole time. And yeah, I agree with your point and just wanted to add that.
Yeah, no, that's good. And it seems that is the you know, the phrase toxic masculinity does keep coming up in relation to this movie. And it seems like Brad Pitt would not want to be on the wrong side of that debate. And I think he's I mean, debate's probably not the right word, but he's played some, you know, these super cool macho characters that I think people kind of idolize, and we don't need to relitigate Fight Club, but you know, and maybe some people have taken some of the cooler characters that he's done the wrong way, and it seems this is this notion of, yeah, he's so good at being an astronaut, and he's so cool and so famous, but it's him turning around and accepting that he's done something wrong and having to be vulnerable and speak with Eve and admit that, you know, just being cool all the time is not the best thing that a man can be.
Exactly. And the other thing that, like, I haven't really seen this, and it's a pretty small point, but I guess it ties in a little bit to what we've discussed, is I just sort of my first reading on the movie was well, I mean, the toxic masculinity stuff is so obvious, and also just the father-son stuff is so, as somebody again who has seen all of James Gray's movies, it's in all of them, and it's just, you just kind of expect it. So, like, none of that was surprising to me, but I just sort of felt that I really enjoyed the way that the movie, maybe unintentionally, maybe intentionally, but portrays the modern, like, average person's experience with technology. Like, I sort of feel like, and I mean technology, like, not space travel technology, I mean the technology we are currently using to record this, you know, sort of the internet and all of these things, where we're just continually trying to advance to find the new thing, and what's happening to the world, it's being shocked, you know? It's like, it's something that could come from an electrical socket, which is what powers all of our technological devices. And I thought that was really interesting. It's like, that's the thing that's sort of fighting back, and it propels us further to find, or propels Roy further to find out that everything he wanted was already on Earth anyway. And what I'm saying is, again, we see Roy in pretty early on, if not immediately. We're introduced to him already wearing a helmet. The helmet's basically a bubble stopping Roy from connecting after Trump was elected. It is very, very popular to talk about the quote unquote bubble that we have all created for ourselves through our own use of technology. And I just sort of felt like Roy and Clifford both being shown as somebody continually looking for something else as opposed to just looking at what's in front of them is sort of like, it's not that different from scrolling through Twitter, Instagram, whatever your social media of choice is, scrolling through all these things. And the thought process is always like, why do you keep scrolling? It's because you think that the cool thing might be the next thing you scroll past. And that's never fucking the case. You know, it's just not. And it's not like you're sitting there on Instagram and be like, I don't know, this next photo might be the one that changes my life. It's not going to change your life. People's lives are not changed by Instagram, unless maybe they're Instagram influencers, in which case, go fuck yourself. But, and I just thought that was a really... That's something that's really subtle and runs throughout the movie. And again, ties to a lot of the things we talked about with Clifford. He's just somebody blind to these things. And the idea that, and again, the humans established on the moon is just another version of the same thing. I'm sure there's like some moon, it would be the same Instagram, but there's moon Instagram as well, you know? There's moon Instagram influencers. We're carrying the same shit in orbit with us. And the idea is to... realize that it doesn't matter and turn around. And I just think that works as a nice reading that goes hand in hand with what Clifford's doing. And since space travel relies so heavily on technology, and since the term that we're getting for what's destroying the world is something that ties so interestingly or so neatly into the devices that we're using, I think it's there, you know? I just think it's interesting.
Yeah, the surge is the weapon, and even when the news reports are coming, it's just unpredictable electricity. And I don't mean that, and you see a bunch of people being shocked and being electrocuted and dying, but it's just, you just see lights going on unpredictably and things shutting off, and it just does seem like, yeah, as you said, this this force of technology that is so great, but now is unpredictable and uncontrollable.
Yeah, exactly, and it's something that a tool that can make us either more connected, and then at some point it helps us disconnect further. Like, I don't know, again, as we sort of build our bubble, that it sort of puts us in the spacesuit with Roy, you know, just sort of with our own world and trying to push everybody away from it that doesn't just easily fit into it. But yeah, I just thought that was a good reading that should be brought up.
Yeah, and the sunset profile pic would definitely be replaced by like the Earth set profile pic once you can afford to go to a moon.
look, it's the blue dot. I do want to point out just a couple quick filmmaking things, shots that I really liked. I love the as Roy goes into the coolest recording studio in the universe, which of course the production design on Mars is just incredible. Like everything about the production design in this movie, I thought was great, but especially on Mars, it seems where they really swing for the fences, and I loved it.
Yeah, is it too like cool and seemingly not utilitarian enough, or something that should be so kind of cold and buttoned down?
So I think it's a utilitarian place that has sort of been turned. Over time, over people being there for too long, I think that it's just sort of because you look at some of the places they're walking through, it's pretty standard, feels like an underground sort of that could be anywhere, just an underground like basically we're a loading dock at some apartment building or whatever. It feels like that's the initial design, and as people have been so far removed from the Earth for so long, they've sort of added their sort of like personal weirdness that has developed has sort of affected the place. So it feels like somewhere that was designed by NASA that has then been changed by the people who have been forced to actually live there in practice. You know?
Okay.
Does that make sense?
Yeah.
And that's sort of how I feel with the Mars stuff. And I think it's really, really good that way. But when I think her name's Helen, the woman from Loving, Helen, when she is locked out of their recording session, and Roy just turns and is like, thank you, sort of nod. And then the camera, you know, any other movie, we cut and, you know, we're right into the recording studio with Roy. What we get is we see Helen turn around, camera tracks back with her for like way too long in the language of most movies, and as that was happening, I was like, what are we doing here? Like, what is this? Why is this happening? Because, you know, naturally that shot is left in there because it's telling you that you need to care about this character a little bit, or we need to think about this character's journey. And I thought that was a really very brief way of, and as we learn more about Helen as time passes, her parents were killed by Cliff, and that's why she sort of helps Roy get to Cliff. But I think she's meant to show us this another example of somebody who is left in the wake of people being like, no, you've come too far, turn back, or being stopped by somebody who is in control. And I think it's notable that she is a woman who is not white. And I just sort of thought that that was a very quick way of showing the way that somewhere that a white man can get into very easily. You know, you can just, somebody like Helen is just turned back immediately. And then how that sort of pushes her life along, and also pushes her actions throughout the rest of the movie along. And again, which in the language of this movie are positive actions, but to NASA would not be positive actions. You know, the idea is that maybe if she had been included, maybe if everybody had been included, then maybe we're just sort of, we're working together in a way that is more helpful long-term.
Yeah. And to just put more of a face to those people that Cliff killed, you know, after their mutiny, after they wanted to go home, mm-hmm. it's kind of just, you really don't have time or impetus to think of that. But then once we have somebody that we get to know a bit and can actually speak for them, then that gives that much more gravity to those deaths that were off screen.
Yeah. And the one other shot is, I'm sure you noted this as well, is when Roy is watching video of Cliff on the tablet, that sort of clear tablet, and we're seeing above the tablet across his face, and then track down to and like it looks like Brad Pitt's really given a lot emotionally behind it, and we just can't see it. And it's just sort of, I think that's a perfect visual representation of basically his father stopping him from giving everything to the outside world, giving what he holds inside to the outside world, right? Because as he starts to feel this emotion, as he starts to learn about seeing this footage of his father, we get this glass that comes in front of him, this window that's sort of just stopping him from further reaching out and showing who are now an audience, like a movie audience, but we stand in for everybody in his life, stopping him from showing us his feelings. And I thought that was a really, really cool shot. And James Gray doesn't really do a lot of those in his movies, really showy visual stuff. And I just thought that was great. And again, also somebody like Brad Pitt giving an emotional performance that, and then agreeing to have it covered up entirely. Fucking love that guy. He's the best.
Yeah, no, that's kind of one of my favorite shots going in this. And I'll say that I'm being hard on this movie because I think so much of it is so good that that's why I'm being somewhat nitpicky. But yeah, something like that where it's not really sad, it's told visually. And yeah, that notion of he does get a chance to do some acting, and we're just we're held apart from it by technology and his father simultaneously, I think was a wonderful bit of storytelling.
Yeah, yeah. And I will say, like, so the ending of this movie, which is kind of all I have left. I don't know if you have anything else that you wanted to add. So when I saw this movie, you're not going to believe this. I saw this movie with another person, the first time I saw it. And, I said to her, like, immediately, pretty much like as soon as we started talking about it, I was like, I wish the movie had ended on, Brad Pitt being carried out of, or Roy being carried out of a spacecraft. And, then I did a bunch of research and I found out that's kind of what James Gray wanted too. Or at least that's my hypothesis on where he wanted the movie to start, because I found this quote from him saying that last 40 seconds was very much a collaboration and a compromise, but I was okay with it because if the movie felt like a downer, I was going to get very upset. The point of the movie isn't that he goes to Neptune, confronts his father, and then becomes a miserable guy. The degree to which that was clear to the audience, I was okay with it. And besides, my ending is in the movie before those 40 seconds. And the idea is that, like, earlier this year, there was a reshoot to add basically what I suspect comes after that shot that I've pointed out. I don't know for sure. I just am using the timing of 40 seconds. It feels right that him doing his final psychological test, Roy doing his final psychological test, and then having his coffee and waiting for Eve. That feels like the thing that was ended and that was added. And everybody from Brad Pitt, James Gray being very diplomatic about it. And Gray has said in interviews, this, you know, he had Final Cut on his last three movies. This is a movie he didn't have Final Cut on. And he sort of feels like the movie is 90% his and then 10% compromise to get it made. And the compromise is worth being able to be told to tell the story. And I think I would rather see filmmakers I love compromise to tell the story that they want to tell to an extent, just because a lot of my favorite things have come out of compromise, you know, and a lot of my favorite movies. And I'm old enough now to realize that, like, I kind of like some of the things that studio heads want us to have. And I think that the ending of this movie is a perfect example of that, in that most of it I don't like, because that extra, let's go get a coffee, Liv, all that stuff I don't like. And because it just, what I said, Absence of Malice is another movie I watched earlier this week. And I was reading about the ending of that movie, which is about Sally Field and Paul Newman. There's a scene that just feels so tacked on at the end of that movie. And it's like an epilogue. And I was reading up about that and how it just used to be this go-to thing in studio filmmaking to you do your test screenings. And then the audience was unclear about whether or not the men or the man and the woman ever spoke to each other again. And the studio's reaction to that was always put an epilogue with these two characters speaking to each other. And yeah, like, you're the best you can do is leave it open-ended, but they have to see each other again. And that's exactly what the ending to this is. It's so, like, classical. And I think, like, Eve is given so little throughout the movie that, you know, I mean, we haven't talked about her at all. I think she has like one line. And it's not that James Gray has no history of writing engaging female characters, you know, and I'm sure he's very aware of this criticism. But I think adding her coming back to see Roy with no indication that Roy has really done anything to sort of apologize or whatever, she just sort of shows up. And I just think that's shitty. And for a character who's already nothing, it's so, so much more insulting to have her come back without being given a vocal reason. That said, I do really enjoy the very last line or the very last word of this movie, like a psychological test, which I don't have, I don't know for sure that part was a part of the reshoots, or if they had shot it already and maybe cut it out of the movie, because it does fall in line with what happens earlier, because one of the first things we see in this movie is Roy doing a psychological test, right? And we see that first psychological test, the way we look at it, it's sort of like, it looks kind of shoddy, like it was shot on like shitty old film by comparison. And I don't know why it looks like that. I don't think the movie gives us a clear answer. It's just unclear. We're looking at this guy and it's unclear. And the last psychological test he does, where he's talking about, I will live and love, yada, 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 I'm willing to feel all these things. He is clear. Like, we're seeing him crystal clear, you know, it's sort of like something has been removed between us and him, and he is willing to use the last word of this movie, submit, which I love that the last word of this movie is submit. And if that's a part of the compromise that takes away 10% of James Gray's quote-unquote vision, I think that's the part where he's like, maybe some of that compromise is worth it. Because I just think that the last word Roy says is submit, to give himself over to something, to sort of let go, is really nice. And to go back to that shot of him being pulled out of the craft, the way he sort of reaches out and takes somebody else's hand, we get, I believe, a single tear, which I'm in support of because it's coming from Brad Pitt's eyes as opposed to some shittier actor. And that like little smile that he gives, again, a very, very subtle smile, because Brad Pitt never does anything, never turns anything up to 10 in this movie. But I think that, as he's being carried off, to that's him submitting visually. And that actually feels like the last shot of a James Gray movie. As we talked about, The Lost City of Zed, that has a very good last shot and sort of his previous movie, The Immigrant. And they visually drive home these ideas. And that felt like the ending to me. And that's why, and I think this ties into some of your criticism, like the last 40 seconds feels a little tacked on to me. But again, 90% of it feels tacked on. And then the use of the word submit and the filmmaking choices they use at the beginning to sort of fog up his test and to show it cleanly on the end. I think that sort of makes sense and works with the sort of negotiation that has to happen to make a movie like this. And again, if 90% of it's a great James Gray movie and 10% of it is people with a money, like a satchel of money over their shoulder demanding things, I'm like, all right, cool. If that's what it takes to get Ad Astra, it's worth it every time.
Yeah. I was going to bring up that the part where he can't walk out by himself, like you just you see him kind of start and then his legs give out and he seems to just kind of lean on everybody around him, I think is speaking to that visual the metaphor that you're getting
yeah
at.
And then the camera tracks down to what is it, the empty seat, and if that's the last shot of the movie, that's like this really really great visual ending that tells Roy's whole story without words in one shot or one series of three shots, I guess, but yeah, it would have been amazing, but it's just like you have 100 million as opposed to 25 million. So you gotta make some concessions, I guess.
Yeah. And then it's still going to lose money, but anyway,
well, whatever. I mean,
that's what I kind of, that's why I'm a little surprised on that's your take on it, because I think it had, you know, it had initial test screenings that were bad and then they did some reshoots and, I just see the kind of the handprints of studio intervention in a lot of this, especially that ending. And I think, as I said, this movie tries to have it both ways. I think that it's not his vision. And he's very diplomatic in interviews, James Gray, about collaboration. And that could be entirely true. He could, because he provides some examples, as he loves doing in interviews, by the way, telling stories about other collaborations or people, him or other people who, didn't get to do exactly what they want to do, but then the result was something greater than this singular vision. It feels like all the studio intervention would be for this to be a bit sweeter and a bit more accessible and a bit more on the surface, which is often what you don't like in things.
Yeah, I just sort of think that they found a way to communicate enough to me that a lot of the times when they're spelling things out to me, I was thinking about something else entirely anyway, you know? And
yeah.
So I like, no movie's ever going to give me 100% of what I want. So I don't know. They gave me plenty to think about.
Yeah. And they gave me plenty as well. And I was, mostly playing devil's avocado to try to get, to get your feelings on these things, even though, I enjoyed this movie a lot more than it probably sounded like I did, but it's because you and I both like James Gray and Brad Pitt and this movie in general that I think it was worth kind of interrogating those feelings for.
Oh, for sure. And I think, we're kind of at a point where James Gray has become this filmmaker who, this happens every once in a while. Sometimes for filmmakers, it happens for a long time, like a prolonged period of their career. Sometimes it happens for a very short period of their career. But we're kind of at a point where nobody's allowed to say anything mean about James Gray and his filmmaking, just because we're kind of at a point where we want all of his movies to succeed because we need them to succeed, because he makes exactly the type of movies that we want to continue being made. And so I think it is important to have the devil's avocado present in these discussions, because I have no interest in all critics being aligned on everything. I have as much interest in that as I have in like the Armand White type of critics who will just write a positive review of Grown Ups 2 just because literally nobody else is doing it. You know? So yeah, I think it's certainly worth investigating.
So next week, Grown Ups 2.
Grown Ups 2. We're finally doing it. thanks for listening to the MacGuffin Men, and check back next time.